Hey, it's episode 429 of the 343 podcast. Today, I have Tabaré Ramos on the line. He reached out, wanted to talk about youth soccer development here in the United States. Of course, he needs no introduction. World Cup veteran, has ample coaching experience at both the professional and, surprising to hear, at the youth level as well. It is significant, and we're going to hear a lot about it, and I think you're going to learn a lot about it. So here we go. Coaches, by the way, you're going to be hearing a lot about coaching education and how Tab Ramos got his start in coaching, as well as a little bit of mine. You want to go to 343coaching.com. There are free and premium coaching education products for you there based on the pioneering work, the unprecedented work of Brian Kliban here in the United States. Don't hold off on the opportunity to learn from the best. So again, 343coaching.com is where you guys want to go. And parents, you need to be coaches off the field as well. And you have to know quite a bit about soccer if you want to guide and mentor your kids appropriately. For you, we've codified our decades worth of experience at 343masterclass.com. Head on over there, sign up right away. It's particularly good ahead of the World Cup, mind you, because now you're going to be able to sit with your kid and see the World Cup games through different eyes and be able to communicate with your kid in a much more observant, discerning way with astute eyes. And lastly, if you happen to be coaching in the 7-versus-7 format, you go to 7v7coaching.com. All right, everybody, I hope you enjoy this episode with Tabaré Ramos. Here we go. Well, first off, awesome to see you, and thank you so much for doing this. It's a privilege and honor, and I'm not blowing smoke up your butt. You know, it's just a sincere thing because when I was a child, I grew up watching you. I grew up watching the national team. I was at the Rose Bowl in 1994 with my family, watching the World Cup matches. So thanks again, Tab. And for the audience, and for the audience's sake, you know, this is something that I've been wanting to have a conversation with you for a very long time. Obviously, you know, my brother and his work, and I was always kind of in the background.
Right. No, first of all, thank you for having me on. And I know you're not one for blowing smoke, by the way. So, okay. You know, which is a great thing, really, because, you know, I'm a firm believer that if you believe in what you're saying, there's really no hiding. There's no place to hide. You just have to say how you feel, and you could be wrong, and that's all, because we all have different experiences that we live through, and we see the world a little bit different. But I think those experiences allow us to have an opinion. And as long as my opinions are mine, I'm good with that, because I know I have the best intentions. So that's it. After that, whatever happens, happens.
Yeah. I've never watched your show with Tom. I presume you guys maybe have things prepared. The way I usually do things is I'm unprepared. I just go off of the cuff with my experiences and what I think I know, and I just bring up topics and we just chat.
It's fine. With Tom, we have certain subjects that we know we're going to talk about every day. But for the most part, it's open. Like, we don't discuss beforehand what's going to happen within a topic. So I'll give you an example. We may be talking about, you know, Gio Reyna scored a goal this weekend. And we can both be opposite sides of that. Oh, great. You know, it'll give them confidence. Or, hey, it's about time. You know, so, you know, all of those things, they always depend. And I don't, honestly, when you talk about stuff like this, I don't like the rehearsal part of it. You know, it has to come out like how you feel at that moment. And sometimes you can get it wrong. And sometimes you can look back at it and say, you know, maybe I shouldn't have said that way. Maybe I should have said it this way. But at the end of the day, you know what? Like I said before, I have good intentions, so I'm not worried.
Brilliant, Tab. Did you have anything top of mind that you perhaps wanted to discuss? Or if not, I have things on top of my mind.
No, whatever you want. I mean, I'm assuming that we're going to discuss, to a certain extent, youth development, right? Because that's sort of up your alley, I think, and what you talk about. But we can discuss anything you want, from youth development to national team to the coaching situation to whatever you want. I'm good.
Yeah, brilliant. So I want your perspective because of all your experiences, right? Not just as a player, but you've coached for many, many years and coached in a whole bunch of different environments, youth national teams, pro at the USL level, pro at the MLS level, and the senior men's national team as well, and being an assistant, which I don't know how you feel about it, but it's different than being a head coach, very different than being a head coach. It's kind of like you have a lot of responsibilities off of your shoulders, but you still feel a huge weight. to make sure that the head coach is supported. So I just want you to kind of riff.
Yeah, let's go into those. Yeah. Let's go into those topics because they're really interesting, actually. Yeah. However you want to ask that. Yeah.
Yeah, no. So my question, I kind of wanted to frame it that way. So the audience is, I mean, they know on paper, Tab, what you've done, but it's very different than lived experience. And right. many times it seems like people make some mistakes and say, well, if it happens at this level, it shouldn't happen at that level. Or, you know, maybe here's a question for you. What's the difference in coaching club versus a national team? How about we start there and then we'll just pull on that thread?
However you want to do it. I'd rather start by sort of speaking a little bit about the experience of becoming a coach. Because I think that's really important. I think everyone has a different approach according to whatever coaching education they've had, whether the coaching education has been on paper or it has been actually live on the field. So there's different kinds of getting your coaching education. And I would rather start with the beginning rather than with the end, because that's a great question for the middle or the end, right?
Yeah.
What, you know, so let's just go. Let's just start with the basic stuff.
Well, let's do that then. You know, I'll frame it this way then. When I got my first coaching job, it was a varsity high school coach at age 24, and I didn't know what the heck I was doing. Imagine, you're 24, and I was still in college. I was doing my master's degree, and I accepted this job because people saw me playing, and they're like, oh, okay, I guess you can kick a soccer ball, so why don't you take over the varsity high school team? I didn't know anything, Tab. I was doing to them what was done to me in my youth, which was not very structured. It was kind of all over the place. So maybe you can give us your origin story with respect to when you first started getting coaching. What was that coaching job? And were you a little bit intimidated because you probably didn't know what the heck you were doing either?
Right. So, I retired from playing in 2002. Shortly after, I decided I wanted to coach my kids, like a lot of retired players do, like a lot of people do in general. So I decided to take an F license just to be on the sideline. You know, I was on the sideline with the kids. That allows you or covers you insurance wise to be on the sideline, so I could do it. I felt like I knew a little bit about soccer, at least, you know, with my playing career. So, okay. So the following year, I decided to take my B license. You know, Marcelo Balboa and a couple other guys were taking a B license, and it was a pro license, you know, like pro players they brought together. And to be fair, I took that license and I realized during the license, like all of the things that I didn't know, like I realized and it hit me for the first time that although I had obviously played in 3 World Cups, played overseas in Spain, played in America, all these things, how I was one of those players that was not really in tune with speaking with the coaches and talking with the coaches and really understanding the game. I played mostly by instinct. So I felt like as my career was going on, I wasn't really learning. I was just playing the game because the game was fun for me. From the first moment I started playing till I retired, it was basically fun. And I realized what I didn't know. And when I took my B license, I kind of started to fall in love with the game, with the actual game. You know, like it's different, you know, like being a player is one thing. But when you retire and you watch the game from the other side, it's completely different. And so I started signing up for different symposiums and things they had. And I signed up for this one that was called Adidas ESP. I don't know if you remember, you know, about 20 years ago, Adidas used to do all of these things around the country. I signed up for one. Well, I show up to the event, to the symposium, and who's sitting next to me? Xavier Azcargorta is sitting next to me. Right. So he says, hey, Tab, I sort of knew him a little bit from Spain, right? He was coach at Bilbao. He coached at Valencia. And of course, you know him because he coached Bolivia. He coached Chile. I mean, this is one of the geniuses of the world, right? Coaches that coach that much, they usually know more than a little bit, right? And so he says to me, what are you doing here? And I say, mister, as we call everybody from Spain, mister, I think I want to be a coach. And he goes, when did you retire from playing? I said, I just retired last year. And he says to me, well, if you retired last year, you don't know anything about coaching. You got to go learn to coach the game. It's two totally different things. He goes, I would recommend that you go to the youngest age group you can coach and start learning how to be a teacher. That's what he said to me. And I took that. I really took that to heart. So I started, I was coaching little kids at the time, like a U7 or whatever. It didn't matter. I started by taking over a U9 team. So I coached a U9 team for a full year. And during that year, I learned how to be on my knees to teach kids how to hit with the instep, how to hit with the inside of the foot, how to, all of the, like, that was really the beginning of the game. That's how I started to coach. And then the following year, I coached a U11 team for a year. And the following year, I coached a U12. And then the following year, a U13. Then I did a U14 team. This is in the youth. This has nothing to do with the top of the game. This has to do with me traveling to Jefferson Cup, the President's Cup, the Surf Cup, whatever, all these cups, like, you know, getting points, getting ranked, getting, like, all of these things that, you know, getting parents, trying, you know, cutting a kid every once in a while, having discussions with parents, parents arguing about their kids, getting more playing time, all of those things. I lived all of that. Then I decided to take my A license. And then I contacted Xavier Escargorta, and I said, hey, coach, I just want to let you know that all the question you asked me and the things you asked me to do, I did it. I did it. I went through all the years. I think I'm learning how to coach. And then I started Wilmer Cabrera towards the end of when he was at the U17s. He said, Tab, why don't you come with me and help me a little bit a couple weeks at the residential and see how you feel about coaching? So I did that. I went a couple weeks with the residential program. Then Thomas Rungan said to me, hey, Tab, I heard you were at the U17s. You want to come with the U20s and help me out? I helped him out with two cycles as assistant coach, picking up the cones, putting the cones down, learning how a coach, you know, thinks before the game. Like, he was thinking, you know, new things to pick up. Like, for example, Thomas was really thorough about going position by position. What happens if we get a red card to the right back in the second minute? What happens if we get a red card to the defensive mid? Who goes where? How do we sub? Like, all of these things started to sort of come together for me. And then after being assistant for a couple cycles on U20s, the U20 job opens up. Who gets fired? Thomas Rungan. I'm one of his assistants, not a top assistant. He had Dave Vandenberg was his top assistant. He had a couple. I was just like an assistant, but more a helper. It's not like I got paid or anything. So then U.S. Soccer called me after they fired Thomas Rungan, and they say, Tab, would you like to take the U20s? We just, you know, obviously we just fired Thomas, and we need to take the team to France. We have two games against France. Would you take the team? And I go, absolutely not. I said, it's a great opportunity. I appreciate it, but I'm Thomas's guy. Like, he just got fired. I'm not taking his team. And they say to me, Thomas asked us to call you to take the team. And at that point, I said, hey, you know what? If Thomas asks, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to call Thomas, make sure this is what happened. And if that's the case, I'll call you back. I called Thomas, and Thomas right away, he was the best to me. He said right away, Tab, you're ready to coach. You should be a coach. You really should be doing this. I want you to take the team. Take the team and show them how you can coach. And then maybe they consider you when they pick the new coach. And that was the beginning. And then obviously the 20s were open up. I ended up getting the job. And then I did four cycles with the U20s, right? And you kind of know the rest. At the same time, I assisted Jurgen Klinsmann in the 2014 World Cup. I became the youth technical director. I added national teams. And so then I took Houston Dynamo, and, you know, the rest. So I wanted to say that because I think a lot of people think that I think they group all former players into one category. I think there's really, and I'm not saying anyone, there may be some former players who are just great at stepping off the field and becoming a great coach the next day. Becoming a great coach takes a long, long time. It's not easy. There's a lot of learning. There's a lot of mistakes that you make. And I took coaching very seriously, and I learned a lot. So that was my pathway to get to where I got.
This is absolutely brilliant, Tab. I had no idea, first and foremost, that you did all that youth stuff and not even at the highest of levels. And I think you're absolutely correct. You have to go through those experiences, not only to understand the ecosystem, the landscape, and everything that comes with it, but to kind of, it's the training wheels, isn't it? It has its own challenges. Don't get me wrong. It's very challenging. But like from my personal experience, since I didn't know what I was doing, it would have been better in retrospect if I did start with like U11s or U12s or U10s. What do you think? I have my own opinion. makes it maybe easier for a coach who's just getting started to go there? From my viewpoint, it's things like speed of play. It's things like maybe the credibility that you have with your players. For instance, if you just retire or something and you go straight into the highest of levels, maybe you don't get that sort of respect and the level of play is too fast for you to process and make good decisions as a coach.
Well, I mean, it could go either way. And that's why I say, you know, my path is not for everyone. My path was one of learning because I wanted to be prepared for all of it. You know, when you coach children in particular, you have to be very patient because, you know, all of a sudden your best player is growing this year. And for 3 months, all of a sudden you're thinking, what have I been doing wrong that he used to be able to pass the ball this way and now he can't? Or he used to be able to run this way and now he can't. Those are little challenges that you don't suffer later on, right? When you coach in pros or when you coach in adults, it's completely different. It's, you know, players are kind of the same. And if they're not playing well, they're either lacking confidence or they're injured, right? But with the little kids, you learn all those nuances of them growing, of them, you know, becoming more confident, of them, you know, being allowed to do things. Like, for example, you know, then you learn as a coach to do, you can get away with things. Like, for example, with the U9 team, I wouldn't allow them to kick the ball out of bounds, regardless of where the ball was on the field. So I tried little things that I think helped our team. So even if the ball was in our box and we had to get it out of there, they knew they were not allowed to kick the ball out of bounds. So somehow they had to figure it out, either by dribbling or by kicking it down the line or by keeping it alive. You know, you can try things. And of course, sometimes we failed. Sometimes we got scored on. But, you know, when you look at the, you zoom out, you realize, okay, but these are good things. These are teaching the kids. You're putting them in a tough situation that they have to get out of. And of course, they can kick the ball out of bounds. They can do that later on when they're, you know, 18, they can kick the ball out of bounds. They don't have to now, right? So there's no repercussions to kicking the ball out of bounds. So let's just play. Let's see how we can play. So you can take risks on things like that. And sometimes you make mistakes and sometimes you play three forwards and you should play two or one, or, you know, sometimes you don't realize you don't respect the other team because you think, okay, they're just playing kickball and they have their biggest guy up front and we'll deal with that. And then you realize, no, their biggest guy, I need three guys to hang on their shirt. And I live that. I went to Dallas Cup with a team and I had little guys who were really good, by the way. We had a great team of little guys who could pass the ball. And we got it to Dallas Cup and we played a team with a big guy up front. And literally my guys were like holding the shirt that they couldn't hold the guy, you know. So like you're dealing with all these things that I think, you know, I went, Gary, from 2004 to 2009. I didn't watch a single MLS game. I barely watched the national team play at all. I might have seen 3 or 4 games. I was in it. I was in the youth game. That's what I did. And you know, when you're in the youth game, it's almost every day of the week and it's every Saturday and Sunday. You're either traveling or you're playing 2 games, one on Saturday, one on Sunday. It's you're all in or you're not in at all. And I was all in. And looking back, I loved it.
That's awesome. Something I know the audience here, which is comprised of a lot of youth coaches, would be interested in, as am I. Do you think maybe you were afforded a little bit more grace with those youth teams because of your history, because of your playing history, et cetera? Because a lot of youth coaches might want to do things like you just suggested, don't kick it out of bounds, or certain of this stuff, but they're not Tabaré Ramos, right? So the parents might be look at things a little bit differently. The club directors might look at you a little bit side-eyed. So I don't know if you can make some remarks around that, because we suffer... different challenges.
No, I agree, of course. And I also benefited from the fact that if I was coaching a team, the best players wanted to come play for me.
Right.
I didn't really have to go recruit players. Like the following year, there'd be a tryout and like the best players came to me. And so that's no question. That's an advantage. So when I say, hey, I had little guys and they all could play. Well, they were the best players like within a couple hours of here. I had a player in particular that drove from Connecticut 3 times a week, over 2-hour ride each way to come play for me. And if it's me, I wouldn't do it. You know, it could be Maradona coaching the team. I'm not driving 2 hours each way for my kid. Like, yeah. I'm not doing it. So did I have some benefits? Absolutely. Were parents a little bit more respectful because it was me? I'm sure they were. although there were disagreements that I had with parents at one point, and I was thinking, well, wait a minute. So you think that your son, this was a clear one, and I'm not going to say the kid's name because I don't want to do that, but there was a kid in particular who was a very good player, ended up playing for the Red Bulls after, and I put him at center back just because I felt like we had the ball a lot and my center back could go into midfield, and he was just another. And the father was just adamant that his son was a central midfielder. He was not a center back. And he had never kicked a soccer ball. He had never played. He was no. And I'm thinking, if this is happening to me, imagine what's happening all over the country. Because if my son wanted to play baseball and Derek Jeter was the coach and he put my son at third base, and I'm thinking, my son's a shortstop, you know? Who am I to tell Derek Jeter that, you know, you need to put him at third base? I mean, but people think this is what youth soccer is like. And so I can understand that, you know, being a coach in youth soccer is really, really difficult in this country. You know, there's unfortunately coaches put up with a lot. And if anything, I'm always defending coaches because it's easy. Everybody is always blaming our coaches for youth development. And I don't think it's that. If anything, look at the effort our coaches make just to get their licenses and how much that cost. I mean, and then they get blamed because they get paid. Well, you have to get paid. This is like you took your coaching education so that you could be a proper coach. You know, there wasn't one day, I'll say this. There wasn't one day when I took my daughter to horseback riding where they said, it's okay, don't pay. It's fine. No, if we didn't pay, we couldn't get on the horse. Yeah. There's no horse if you don't pay. And I'm not saying soccer should be about paying. What I'm saying is that problem should be solved at a much higher level, not at that level. The coaches are not to blame.
Yeah, no. And it's not that, like they're getting wealthy, Tab. It's very low paid, you know, considering the time, energy, effort, and headache. You know, I just recorded an episode last week that it's not just the time that you put during training and on the weekends, but the typical coach is getting text messages from parents. You know, he's getting emails from parents. You're having to, you know, put out fires because of all the things that the parents could say. Why didn't
coaching multiple teams?
Yeah, well, coaching multiple teams. Why did Johnny only play 20 minutes this weekend? It doesn't make any sense. And Mikey is playing 40 minutes, and my Johnny scored last week. So it's this whole thing that youth coaches are putting up with, and it's very frustrating to see them vilified. I stick up for them all the time. I mean, obviously I'm biased as well, but it's an important thing to consider because for us to get better, Tab, we have to kind of heal first or understand what reality is first instead of just throwing bombs everybody's way. I have two follow-up questions regarding your youth teams, okay? Number one is I'm curious as to whether you stuck with the same team for multiple years. And then, you know, those players, because you mentioned one kid ended up going to the Red Bulls. I'm curious as to what their trajectory ultimately ended up looking like, those kids. Did they go to college? Did they quit the sport? Did a number of them go professional? So we can start there, and then I have some other ones.
So it's a bunch of questions in one. But I'll start with the first one. So I did coach one team probably for about 3.5 years, same team. And then I kind of switched teams. So I did both, including 1 year, I coached two teams at once. So I know what it's like when coaches have to go set up cones at 6 o'clock and be there 6 to 7:30 with one team and then 7:30 to 9 with another team. So I know the challenges of that. Players. I'll give you one example. There were many. There's one of my players plays for Haiti, so he'll be at the World Cup this summer. You know, there was a bunch of other players that went from Princeton to Maryland to like big college programs. There were a couple that ended up in MLS. There was one player, and I'll give you this example because sometimes we think that we give ourselves credit for developing. And all we're doing really is providing an environment, and players don't necessarily learn because you're the coach. So I'll give you an example. I had a player who was a center back for me. He was the other center back of the two I mentioned to you for a couple of those years. I had him with me He was 3.5, 4, probably 4.5 years I had this player. And so every day, I always made it a point that we started our training session by passing back and forth for 20 minutes, only with the inside of the foot. Every training session, we started with that. Why? Because I always feel like about 80% of the game is about passing the ball with the inside of the foot. So you might as well get really good at that, right? Most of what happens in the game is about 15 to 20 yard passes with the inside of the foot. That's most of what happens. So the first thing you have to master is obviously that. And when I say first thing is after you develop your own relationship with the ball, right? That's the first thing. So I had this player for these many years. Do you know that after being all those years with me, he still couldn't complete passes? He couldn't complete passes. He couldn't play in college after. He just couldn't do it. He was one of those kids that was not, he was more athletic, but he was not in love with the game. And I think the players who are really good, they do more than whatever the coaches tell them, right? So they're with you for your training sessions 2-3 days a week or whatever time you give them. But those few hours you give them, whether they're 6 or 4 or 3, they're not enough. They need to do about 10 on their own. If they're not doing about 10 hours on their own, it's very difficult to make it. And so if I had to say about my discovery with all my players, some made it, some didn't make it, is that the players that went the furthest are the ones that did a lot on their own. It wasn't because I coached them.
Yeah, it's a slice. The coach is just a small slice of it all. You know, my co-host asked me, hey, Gary, what do you think is the influence of a coach into whether a player makes it, doesn't make it? And I asked, just throwing numbers out there, because who knows how to quantify this stuff, right? But I said, maybe 10%, 90% is everything else, 10% maybe, because I do have an opinion that if you're under the tutelage of a poor coach, whatever that means, okay, that you could do some damage to the player's development. I mean, your example that you gave, I mean, you're showing the kid what is proper, what is correct, but then it's up to them to take it and run with it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I made an example. I was at the coaches convention 3 months ago in Philadelphia. It was this January. So I had a couple of different guest seminars that I spoke in. And in one of them, I asked the coaches, I said, okay. I said, you know, because when we talked before about the effect that the coaches have and how much they can do, don't forget, and I'm sure we make it into this, but don't forget the coaches are, so you're the coach at my club. I'm the technical director. So I'm kind of telling you sort of how I want the team coached because I'm answering to above me. In order, who's above me? Above me is the leagues that I enter because these leagues have these standards that we have to maintain. And those standards are so important. And so I'm telling you, okay, you're going to coach a team. You're a great coach, but you're going to play 4-3-3 and you're going to play out of the back and blah, 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 blah. So now you have to do your training session. So, and by the way, your training session has to have the proper activation to start. And then you have to have the proper possession game. And you have to, there's all of these steps that a coach has to take, right? And so I asked the coaches, I said, let me ask you this. All of you guys have a coaching education. I have two. And the reason I can speak is because, as I mentioned to you, I coached everything I feel. I've coached everything. I've taken every license. I have my pro license. And because of that, I can tell you that the one thing I believe the most is what my coach Manny Schalzeit told me when I was 13. The game is the best teacher. After learning all of those things, after coaching for the last 20 years, I can tell you that the game's the best teacher. So I asked the coaches, I go, let me ask you this. I take all of you, we take two teams of 11-year-olds. And on one side, we have 3 times a week, they have a proper session with the proper activation, 1.5 hours, proper activation, proper possession game, proper body of the session, whatever that's going to be, tactical. And then in the end, they play a little bit. Okay, 1.5 hours. Let me take another group of 11-year-olds. All they do is play small-sided games and large games. And let's take them from 11 years old to U18. Who's going to be better off at the end of the day? And by the way, I'm not saying one or the other. What I'm saying is it's not an easy answer. But if I had to bet myself, let me have the guys who have been playing. the whole time. Not the guys who've been doing the proper session. Because I think chances are, after 6 or 7 years, the guys playing all the time have come into every situation that the game's going to offer them. And the guys doing the proper sessions will not.
Yeah, so here's an area where I'm going to push back, Tab, and see what your thoughts are. If you know, I come from a physics background, so sometimes to get enlightened as to what might be a truth is you take extremes. You know, you say, assume a perfect universe, you know, how do things behave? So in this regard, when one says the game is the best teacher and you give those two examples and which one would come out on top, you know, 10 years later, I think to myself, well, why even have coaches then? Why even have coaches or coaching licenses or anything? Why not just host? I mean, what's the point? What is the point of a coach at that point? And I think that if it were true that that extreme example of the game is the best teacher were in fact reality, I think somebody would have discovered it. Like, why would Barcelona have this whole methodology and this whole program, you know, throughout the entire pipeline? Why not just have the players show up and they'll just play every day, pick up soccer?
No, and that's why I made the example of two completely, they're two extremes, right? So if I had to pick one, I'd pick this extreme. So how can I make the training sessions as close as possible to not being robotic? And that's my point with it, right? So how do I not make them robotic? How do I make the connections of a small-sided game? How do I make them in different kinds of games? How do I connect that to the bigger game, right? So that's where the coach comes in. That's my favorite things to do is how do you connect, right? The small-sided game, how do you make that into real soccer somehow? Because at the end of the day, you have to do that, right? And whether that's through, you know, obviously rondos would be one way. The proper possessions, there's a number of different ways you can do possessions. You can do possessions into attack. You can do possessions in one area. You can do possessions when you can't advance until two players go. Like little things that you can do within the actual game, right?
Yeah.
Then going completely into robotic and doing, for example, patterns to goal, which I think, by the way, they're necessary also, right? All of those things are necessary. But my point being that it's not so cut like, okay, what you learn at the licenses is exactly how you have to run the session. No, you have to feel your team. You have to see what players you have. You have to see who you can push more in which area. So the game will dictate to you what's going to be better for the team you have.
Yeah, I just try to be very cautious when I talk about these things because I know a lot of youth coaches want to learn badly and they'll take something like that, the game is the best teacher, as a crutch in many instances to not do anything, right? And just regurgitate, the game is the best teacher. I'm just going to set up small-sided games and let the kids play. And then on the weekends, I'm just going to pull up my lawn chair, not say a peep, not say nothing at all. And it has this whole happy-go-lucky, I don't need to coach really, sort of infestation, if I can call it that, throughout the country. And then come along coaches who, in my opinion, might be doing very, very good work, but from the outside observer, it looks like it's too structured. It looks like it's too robotic because it's not just pickup games all day, every day. And they are giving instructions on the sideline during matches. And then from the outside, they'll be like, see, that guy, he's just developing robots. He's not letting them express themselves. He's killing their creativity, right? When in fact, it's a lot more subtle than that, right, Tab? It's a lot more. I'm sure you've been to Barcelona. I'm sure you've seen those training sessions. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Again, from an outside observer, if they didn't know it was Barcelona with the pedigree, they would be like, see, they're creating robots here.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's a good point because what I was going to say to you is sometimes when people think about youth development is you have to think, okay, what do you want the outcome to be? Right? You have to start with that. What is your outcome? What are you looking for? Is Barcelona, is everybody being Pedri what you're looking for? Is that realistic? Is that realistic for different body types to be Pedri? You know, not every player is the same, so it doesn't apply to the same players. And that's why I was saying, okay, so let's take robotic training where everybody kind of does the same thing. Let's take the game is the best teacher where whatever happens, happens. Okay, so how can I be close to the game be the best teacher and still have players move into the proper spaces. One goes away, one steps into in between lines to receive, checking over the shoulder, you know, like all the little things that you're teaching. How do you keep them on one side of the field until you connect a couple passes and then somebody makes a run and you find the other side? So like, I think that, you know, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but, you know, by taking your licenses, I think all the licenses do is give you sort of the ability to be able to create in your mind different exercises. Like, I don't think I ever coach by opening a book and saying, today I'm going to do this exercise. Is, okay, what do we need today? Okay, so we're playing against Nigeria. They're fast in the back. How do we draw them out so that we can still find, you know, so, okay, so we need to draw them out. How do we draw an exercise where we draw them out? And this is kind of like the beginning. I know when I was with youth national teams, that's exactly what we did. You got the staff together and you said, okay, we have to draw them out. What are some exercises we can do where we're drawing out the other team and then we connect some passes, they come to us, and then boom, you play it back and you go over the top or whatever that is. And I think that's the fun part of coaching, right? It's not taking an exercise from a book. It's you constantly creating. I'll give you another example. And this is a good one because, you know, Jurgen Klinsmann took a lot of criticism being the coach. Everybody thought, okay, you know, Jurgen, you know, right away they said, okay, well, he doesn't have the tactical knowledge or whatever. I tell you one of the things that I loved about Jurgen. Jurgen never, I was his assistant coach for a few years and Andy Herzog was with me. You know, Jurgen would just kind of tell us the topic, what we need that day, and would not allow us to repeat the same exercise ever. So every time we had to go think, okay, what, how can we do this exercise? And I love that because I felt like I was learning so much by trying to do the same thing, but in a different exercise. How do we create a different exercise to accomplish the same goal? And I think those are the, you know, I really have a passion for that. I really love that.
Yeah, there's different methodologies, different ways of teaching for sure. I think that, and maybe we can make that transition to the pro game as well, or the men versus youth. Mm-hmm. In youth, I am of the opinion, strong opinion, if I'm being honest, that repetition is kind of important for them to build up some muscle memory. So if you're trying to teach them, right, how to receive properly, right, how to have your first touch with, you know, with the opposite foot be clean so that on your second touch you can move the ball on. You need reps, constant reps, because you know as well as I do, not every kid is doing this stuff on their own, right, with a wall or anything. So you set up a simple rondo, whether it be 4v1 or 4v0 or whatever, and that is what you train over and over and over again versus, and I'm not saying that you're wrong at all because that was out with the national team, versus say a youth coach is hopping to different activities every single training session. I think the kids will have a harder time kind of mastering anything. You get exposed to a lot of things, but you don't learn anything.
Right. Well, so these are two completely different things. And in one scenario, you're trying to teach. In another scenario, you're just trying to get a result. You're trying to win a game. You're trying to have an outcome. Your exercise has to sort of lull the other team into what you want them to do so that you can exploit that. Right. So it's two completely different scenarios.
You're talking about the national team trying to
right.
do. Yeah. Yeah. No. No. Totally understood. Yeah.
Right. And by the way, I completely agree with you on the repetition, because how are you going to learn to cross a ball if you don't do hundreds of crosses? You don't just become a good crosser of the ball because you're getting older. I used to tell kids that. I'm like, okay, so you think you're going to be able to take a hard shot on goal because now you're bigger, you're going to shoot harder. No, you have to learn to shoot the ball, and you have to repeat that like millions of times, hundreds of thousands of times to get really good at it. Like Brazilians don't hit a ball as hard as they hit them because they just happen to be older or because they played in the favela. That's not why. It's like the amount of shots that they've taken, that's how they got stronger. So repetition, you know, and I know, you know, you wanted to lead into the professional game, but you know, the game now has become so analytical. Metrics are so important. And you say you come a little bit from that world, but it's gotten to the point where, like in Houston, I remember trying to figure out how I'm going to keep a winger to do a bunch of crosses, because even if you're a pro, you still have to do repetitions. There's no avoiding that. You don't just get good at free kicks by not taking any. You have to take them. And if you're a winger and you're going to cross a ball and you're going to swing across it, well, you have to do that like hundreds of times. So I remember saying, I'd like for the wingers to stay and do some crossing. Oh, well, but wait a minute, because, you know, the workload and,
right,
you know, the way they plant the left foot, if they're planting too many times, the work. And I'm like, well, then we're not going to get better. I'm sorry, but we're worried about the plant foot getting too, but then the right foot is not going to cross the ball. So what are we doing here? And we live in that world a little bit, so it's hard to navigate it.
Yeah, and I'm sure you've seen clips here or there. It reminds me of Riquelme. And Riquelme is constantly criticizing the current state of things. Forget Riquelme the person, just the following statement where he's like, yeah, and nowadays, every XG this, XA that, the GPS thing here, how much are you running? Oh, he played good if he ran a lot. He played crappy if he didn't run a lot. And so he's kind of, and I'm paraphrasing, anti all this analytics, right? Running the show versus, you know, what Riquelme was as a player versus just pure instinct and creativity and free expression. And it's not a mystery. I'm not saying anything people haven't already heard. Fabregas and everybody is saying the number 10s are dead. That sort of player is gone. Do you agree with that? And why is that the case?
No, I don't think the number 10 is gone. I think we're waiting for one. I mean, you know, did anybody create Messi? I don't think they did. You know, like, these things happen. You know, and you can say, okay, you know, Messi was at La Masia when he was 12 or whatever, whenever he went, right? But Messi was a player already when he got there.
Yeah, of course.
You know, so like, but he wasn't a player because some coach created him. So let's be honest with that. You know, like, the great players that we're talking about, when you talk about a true number 10, they don't come around often. You need to be in environments that can create that where that's going to happen.
So you think nothing's changed with that sort of attacking midfielder sort of position? Because it seems like modern football the past 10, 15 years has drifted more towards the 8 style, the McKinney style player for central midfield. And if somebody like Riquelme comes around, it's like, nah, he's a luxury player. He doesn't run. He doesn't tackle. He doesn't all these sorts of things. You disagree with that perspective?
I do. I think it's how the coach decides to use the player. I mean, you know, look at Bruno Fernandes, look at, you know, Vitinha, look at, you know, guys like Pedri, look at Arda Güler, you know, look, these guys are real play. Like, these players, these are like the 10 type players. Now, whether they use them a little bit, you know, behind, whether sometimes PSG can use Vitinha as like a secondary 6 or an 8, call it whatever you want. But Vitinha is like, when you think of a 10, like, that's what he can do, right? That's what we're talking about. So same with Bruno Fernandes, same with, you know, some of these guys, they can do that stuff. So I think they're still there. It's just a matter of how the coaches uses them, right? That's my feeling.
Has anything changed from 20 years ago to today?
No, of course, things have changed. I think, when I look at the game today in comparison to 20 years ago, I think we have a lot more, let's just say, good players. Players that can do, you know, when I watch the EPL sometimes, you know, and, or you watch the, like, the big, the important teams in La Liga, what surprises me is how well players can handle the ball under pressure and not lose it, you know, which is not something that we had 20, 30 years ago. You know, that was more difficult. They can all do, you know, you remember Cruyff used to say, you know, the hardest thing in the game is to play simple. I think we have a lot of players who are very good at playing simple now. And before that it was a lot harder for players to do that. And I think it's a product of being in academies. It's a product of having right training. You know, that's a product of that. So I think we can all pat ourselves in the back for putting players in an environment where we can create players that can do all the simple things properly. What we haven't broken through on is creating the great player, right? That's what we're all looking for.
Yeah, no. You played in Uruguay, your youth, correct? Mm-hmm. Up until what age?
I moved to this country a week before I turned 12. So I played my full baby football that they call in Uruguay. I did it there.
Do you remember any of it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember the day I signed at 6 years old. You know, if you go to my Twitter, I have a picture of the Estadio Centenario in the back. And most people will think, oh, nostalgic about Uruguay. No, it's because right next to Estadio Centenario is where I played my first game. My club was actually three blocks from the Centenario. So my first game was played there when I was 6 years old, and I was so afraid to play. And I remember my uncle took me to the team, to Unión Vecinal, which was my club, my full 6 years. And I remember he took me to the game. He's like, no, you're ready to play for a club. You got to go play. You're already 6 years old. And I remember hearing that. And I remember being afraid to go. And he took me. He's like, you've been playing on the streets. You're ready to go. And you know, if you think about it, I was 6 years old. And my uncle took me because he felt like, you've already been playing on the streets for how long? Like, you got to go already. Like, it's time. And I was six. Right. By the time I was eight, we were playing derbies against La Picada, which is the team that's like two blocks away on the same field. Like, we were playing games we had to win at 8 years old already. Like, you have to win those games. I'm not saying we always won them, but like, the parents are there waiting for you to win the game because it's, you know, the U6s play first and the sevens and the eights and the nines. Again, like, it's a derby day. You got to win those games. So, of course, I remember, you know, I remember my mom baking cakes because we're trying to raise money for the club so that we can, for the uniform. Like, I remember all that stuff. That's all, of course, I remember.
Okay, so related to what happens here, I'll let you rant on that for a bit, because obviously it brings up the winning at all costs conversation. Yep. and the winning mentality, and people are fighting on both sides as to how important is winning and how unimportant is winning. And like everything, it's gray, right? It's not black or white. But, you know, me being from Argentina and kind of witnessing the culture there as well at the youth level, everybody wants to win. You cannot lose. Okay. Well, and I think that that is kind of important, but it's not black and white, Tab.
No, but I'll tell you why it's important. You know, winning is important because in order to win, you have to make maximum effort. And that's how you learn. So it's not necessarily about the value of the win. It's more about what you have to do to accomplish that. Right. And when you have two teams that are going as hard as they can because they want to accomplish that, then every play matters. And when every play matters, then you learn on every play. You don't take plays off. And I think that's sort of the advantage. By the way, and I'm going to say, look, first of all, Uruguay is not Argentina, right? It's maybe just as hard. Uruguay is not known for developing as many good players, only because you never hear Uruguayan people talk about, hey, you know, the national team won, but, you know, we're just not playing out of the back enough. Like, this is something you'll never hear, like, ever. Like, in Uruguay, and this doesn't happen, but if you were to tow the ball forward the whole game and just brush her and win the ball back, everybody'd be happy if you won the game. If you didn't win the game, everybody'd be unhappy no matter how you played, which is different than some other places, right? So I'm not saying it's the answer, but what I'm saying is, I think there's a huge value to playing to win all the time.
Agreed, man. I'm glad you said that. I'm glad, you know, people who happen to listen to me or us, they're not hearing it just from me. It's a big topic. And look, I look at your generation. Maybe here's where we can transition a little bit into the pro game, if you don't mind. I look at your generation of players, and I think there was something different versus the current generation of players. And it has something to do with that mentality. Now, I'm not saying the current generation doesn't have the same mentality, that they don't want to win, none of those sorts of things, but it just felt that way, Tab. And maybe I was looking at it through a younger Gary's eyes. Remember, I was 13, 15, 20 years old, very limited experience. What do you know, right? When you're 13, 15, 17, 20 years old, what you're actually watching. But those are my sentiments. Is there any truth to that? How do you view the past generation versus the current generation?
It's different. It's different because they just grew up in a much different environment. You know, we're not the only country that goes through this a little bit. I mean, I can give you an example. I think Germany is a little bit like that too. You know, if you looked at Germany 30 years ago, of course they had great players, but the German teams were known to be hard, right? They had that mentality that no matter what, the Germans, somehow they're going to get one more goal than you, right? It's not quite how they play anymore. You know, that's changed. You know, the players are different. And I think in this country that happened too. I mean, could the cause of that have been maybe more adult involvement in the game? Could it also have been that back when I was coming along with what I want to call the pillars of the game in this country, guys like Marcelo Balboa, like Eric Guinalda, like Tony Miola, like John Hartz, like we were all in a sense pretty hard guys, right? That you had to have personality because we were playing against teams where we didn't belong on the field and we weren't going to the games thinking that we were going to lose the game. We just didn't know how we were going to win it. Like, no idea, but we didn't think we were going to lose. So it's much different. You know, players today, they're much more complete. They play on big clubs. You know, they used to play in big games all the time, which we were not. Just a completely different environment. It's different all around.
Got it. You know, in the 90s, when, you know, Argentina was exporting all these players, Batistuta, Crespo, Verón, everybody, and Italy was the main destination, obviously. But so I'm talking about that era. There was a lot of criticism by the Argentine public when it came time for the national team that, and you know how hardcore we are, that, these guys, because they're making millions of dollars over there, they don't have the heart anymore. They're not going crazy to actually win for Argentina. They want to take care of themselves so that they don't, you know, mess up their club careers. It was kind of like this sense of club over country during that era. And I'm drawing parallels, whether correctly or incorrectly, with the current generation of U.S. men's national team players. Maybe, if there's some truth to that, experiencing some of that, right? Because now they're in Europe, they're making very good salaries. That is their bread maker versus the national team. And the public, anyways, from reports, and I'm not going to say that reports are accurate all the time. You know, when people were skipping out on the Gold Cup or skipping out on camps, that would never happen, right? In other eras. If you get called up, you go to camp, to national team camp, versus saying, no, I'm going to chill with my club team now. So I don't know if there's a little bit of an element to that. I don't know if there's any insight that you can offer with respect to how hard you work for the national team, given your economic circumstances or your club circumstances.
I mean, it can, you know, it's a good point you make. It could have some effect. I do think that when you play for the national team, it's because you want to and because you love to play for the national team, rather than it being a monetary thing or financial thing, but it does help. In particular, back then, we kind of needed the national team. But I will say this, if you look at my history with the national team, I have 81 caps, but in between 1990 and 1994, 95, when I played at Betis, and then when I played at Tigres, I barely came back to play for the national team. I didn't come back to games. I only came in the summer. I played the U.S. Cups or whatever we had, but if they had friendlies during the year, I didn't come to those. I mean, you look at guys like Kobe Jones, for example, who has like 160 games. I bet you he has 100 games that during the time when I was on the team that I wasn't even around for those. Like, you know, so, you know, you have to, sometimes you have to pick and choose where you go, but I think it's how you show up when you show up. I think that's really what matters. And I think the rest of it is, I think, the perception that people have, because if you didn't come to the other games, but now you came to these games and you didn't tear it up, well, now they're going, well, that's because you don't care, because last time you didn't come. And I think it's what you do when you're there. That's what people remember. That's what they want to know. And they want to feel that you're playing for them. And I think I come from a generation of guys that always felt that the fans appreciated the effort that we made on the field. That's how I feel.
Yeah. How about quality wise, Tab? I know you watched the episode with Filippo that we did. And I kind of said that the earlier generation is just as good as the current generation. It's just different eras, right? And you have to basically judge on the times themselves, right? So how good was Tabaré Ramos or Reina or all that whole group relative to their German counterparts, Argentine counterparts, Portuguese counterparts? That is the bar. And then how good are our current national team players relative to their counterparts? I think it's kind of the same. I'd like to know what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were, it seems to me like we were further away back then than they are now. I think players, the players that we have now are closer. I'm not sure if that's due to the effect that all of soccer, so like all the countries are getting better, let's not forget. So I think it's a lot closer now, whereas before you clearly had like the top teams, those dominated. I think now it's closer all around. So I think if that's the way you're going to pose the question, I would say that the players today are closer to the top of the game than we were when I played. If the question was framed in a different way, in terms of just pure talent from a generation then and generation now, I think it's a lot closer than most people would think. But in terms of the gap with other countries, I think we're closer now than we've ever been. But I think there's some ingredients missing there that doesn't allow us to win the games we're not supposed to win now. Yeah. You know, whereas before we won those a lot, actually.
Yeah. What do you think that is? What ingredients?
No, I don't know. Well, we've all talked, you know, and we've been talking about mentality now for quite a few years now, you know, because I think what happened with this current generation is they've, and in particular, since, you know, Greg Berhalter took over the team, it's been, okay, this is the golden generation. We're preparing for 2026. And it was almost like everyone was going through the motions, just waiting to 2026 to arrive. And we're like, okay, but we have a 2022 World Cup coming up. And then we barely qualified to that. We were, I think, tied for third or fourth, right? We barely qualified to the 2022 World Cup. And then we're like, okay, well, that's over. And that was painful, but they were young. Okay, so now let's go to the next one. And now we go into the next. And now we're waiting. We're like, and now people start to talk about, where's the signature win? You know, like, and so we start talking about all these things. And they all come down to one common denominator. We have to be able to beat teams that we're not supposed to win. We expect that. That's who we are. That's who we've always been. Even up to, let's say, the 2014 Clint Dempsey's team. Like, always winning games you're not supposed to win. That's kind of like what people got used to. And I'm not saying you're going to do that all the time, but your fans have to know that you're right there. And I think a little bit of the disappointment this time is that I think a lot of people just don't feel that with this team.
Yeah. Yeah. I have so many questions. Another one I have is, I like to tell folks, whether they're my students or players or whoever it is that will listen, that we're always getting better and better and better as individuals, right? So if you look at yourself when you're 20 years old, when you look at your 15-year-old self, you're like, oh my gosh, I was such an idiot at 15. I know so much more now at 20, which is a fact, right? And then you're 30 and you look at your 20-year-old self, you think your 20-year-old self is a dumbass. And then you're 40 and you look at your 30-year-old self, and on and on and on. And you can do the same with your profession, right? So as a coach, when you reflect back, I don't know if you're denigrate yourself to that extent, right? I'm being a little dramatic here, but I would always do it. Do you do that at least a little bit, or at least is there something that you can highlight that's like, wow, I was totally wrong about this? Is there something that comes to mind? Like a big miss, like not a mistake, but more like a view that you had that was just wrong.
There's a couple I could tell you. If you're asking me on the coaching side, so on the playing side, it's easy. I could look back when I was 17 years old and I would say, you know what, drinking Coke and eating Doritos while getting sun in the parking lot of the back of the national team hotel, that was probably not a good idea. Okay. I should have been in the room resting, eating the proper food. Okay. We didn't know better, and that's what we were doing, right? So easy. As a player, you have many situations like that. As a coach, I would have to say the one I have to look back at is my time at Houston Dynamo, because I really thought, I went to Houston Dynamo thinking, okay, I knew I was taking over basically a last place team. I knew that they had told me, okay, you know, Tab, we're going to sell Elise, Minotas, and Kyoto. We're going to get rid of them. And I was thinking, okay, that's the whole forward line. That's basically what we have. And Wilmer Cabrera was coaching before me, and I had spoken with him a little bit. And, you know, Wilmer just basically defended and countered with those guys. So he was still getting some results sometimes. But that's not the way I'd like to play. So I went to Houston. I made my presentation about how I want to play, because, of course, you need the presentation, you know, with your KPIs and with your style of play, and you need all that stuff. So I have all that stuff. So I do all of that. And of course, mine is high pressing. You know, we're going to be, And this is where I make the mistake. I make the mistake of sticking by my word, right? Because we weren't good enough. At one point, I should have just figured out that we just weren't good enough to high press everyone and play front foot. We should have been conservative. We should have gotten maybe a couple fast guys up top that could just resolve the game and should have got away from really what I believed, because it wasn't the time. And the professional game is about getting results. And if you don't get results, you're going to be out. And I thought, well, of course, they're going to understand. You know, I've been trying to build a team to play this way, but we just don't have the money to buy anyone. So, of course, they're going to understand that after my second year, we're going to renew the team and a new owner is going to come in. And it's not how it works. At the end of the day, if you don't win, you're out. And that's just the way it works. And so my mistake was, you know what, after 5 games in Houston, I should have just said, you know what, we're not playing the way I said in our meeting. I'm going to change the whole thing and I'm going to play different. And I should have done that.
Got it. No, you actually brought up something that I had written down that I wanted to mention to you, is specifically that how much do outside factors impact a coach at the professional level? I mean, I know it depends on the context. It depends on what situation you're in. All of it could range from 0 to 100%, clearly. But too often I see folks criticizing, which I understand is part of the game. Oh, this coach doesn't know what he's doing. He's an idiot, all these sorts of things. And it's like, well, guys, you don't understand the context, right? There's always a deeper story behind the win-loss column. So I just wanted a little bit from you, from your experiences and talking to people, because you have a lot of friends, a lot of colleagues. At the pro level, how much is it the coach versus how much is it everything else, whether it be general managers, sporting directors, ownership, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good question. And, you know, and of course, it's every case is different. But I think for the most part, your feeling about a certain coach usually is the right feeling, right? And by your, I mean people from outside. You get a pretty good feeling. One thing you have to understand about all the coaches is they all know what they're doing. All the coaches know what they're doing. It's how they click sometimes. And let's say all the teams were the same level. If all the teams are the same level, the coach that connects better with the players is the one that's going to do best. The coach that has the better, and I hate this word, but everybody uses, the better culture in the clubhouse, they're going to do better. The happier the players are, they're going to do better. So that's going to be your edge, right? It's never going to be a bigger edge than the team that's better than you. At the end, the best players are going to win games, and there's nothing you can do about it. There's no pill you can take. There's no formula you have. If there's a great Messi playing for Miami now, you can tell whatever you want to your team. If, you know, Messi doesn't even know what he's doing next, so it's impossible that you know what he's doing next. He's going to do something, and he's going to win the game, right? Those cases. But I think what happens is that sometimes, you know, people get caught up. Let me give you an example. So you go to a press conference. You just lost a game 2-1 in the 92nd minute, which happened to me many times. So you go to the game and, you know, you were winning 1-0 with 10 minutes left in the game and you lost 2-1. In the 80th minute, you decided, you know what, I'm going to pull off a forward. I'm going to add a center back. I'm going to go with 5 in the back and I'm going to shut this down. And we're going to win 1-0. Good enough. So you make that move. You lose 2-1. Right? What happens at the press conference? I have a question. Yeah, how come you took out your forward? Your team was, you were in good shape at that point. You know, there's no need for you to take the forward. You know, you have the extra forward and you know, they can keep the ball up there and now you don't have to worry about defending. Yeah, that's a good point. I just thought that, you know, my forward's a little bit tired and I thought if we go 5 in the back, I was really sure that the 3. Okay, so you answer that. Next game, same situation, 80th minute. You don't take your forward out. You add a forward. Like, okay, you lose 2-1. Excuse me. How come you added a forward? You know, all you had to do was shut down the game. You're winning 1-0. So it's the same scenario. No matter what you do, you're going to be wrong if you lose the game because it's only the only thing that matters is the score. The score makes you a genius or makes you a dummy, right? So look at, I'll give you best example, Guardiola, right? who can argue if he's not the best coach in the world, he's one of the best coaches to ever have coached. We can't argue that. Of course, he has great players. He can buy them, right? But we can't argue that the guy is not amazing. But this year, when they lost him, there was like a month and a half when they didn't win games. Everybody's like, oh, Guardiola's time is done. He's lost the locker room. And this is the game. So when you're a coach, you have to be ready for that. That's all.
Yeah. But it's hard to know what reality is, too, because you second guess yourself, I'm sure.
Of course.
We second guess ourselves. Oh, maybe I should not have taken out the striker. I should have just kept playing the way I should play. But we've had experiences where you do that and you lose the game anyway.
But Gary, there are things you can't say, for example, right? Mm-hmm. Like an owner really through your GM, an owner wants you to play a certain player. Or, and I'm not saying that happened to me. I'm saying it happens, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Or a player has two kids and the one, his kid who's in second grade, their teacher is upset with him. And now when you're meeting with your players during the week, your player's upset. He's just not the same. He doesn't, you know, you feel like, okay, I'm not going to play him because I just don't like the fans don't see that. And these are things you can't say. Or there's a certain ankle injury that a player has that you can't talk about because if you talk about it, you know, he has a contract. There's so many things that are happening with the team that no one knows about that you have to deal with, that every coach has to deal with. So I hope I'm answering your question because, yeah, I mean, we're seeing what the fans are seeing, we're seeing it, but we just can't do anything about it.
Yeah, the truth doesn't get out to the public in general. Like things of this nature, which are impactful, they aren't small details, right? They are actually impactful to the win-loss column or to the performances. But like I said before, it's hard to know the truth. Yes, because it's a chaotic system. It's not a hardcore science. It's not X's and O's. It's very fluid. Let me give you a hypothetical just to maybe extract something from you. If Pep Guardiola were to have taken over, I don't know, who's sucking right now in MLS? Take one of the...
Montreal. Yeah. Okay.
Kansas City or something, right? Put him in there with this exact roster, same conditions, everything. What does the win-loss column look like? Does it change or does it basically stay the same? And if it changes, well, he's not going to win every game. How much does it actually change? It's a game of opinions, right? Some opinions are more valid than others, which is why I'm asking you because you have all this experience. What do you think?
Does it change? Yes, it changes a little bit. I would say if I had to give your numbers guy, if I had to give it a number, I would say it changes probably a solid 20-25%. And the reason it does is because it's different playing for Pep Guardiola than playing for someone else, right? So there's an extra motivation that it's on every single player that's in the roster, every training session and every game. And that does have an effect.
Got it.
In terms of the way the team plays, of course, he's going to want to play a certain way and all of those things, right? So it may improve initially. After a while, what will happen is that the players are just not good enough to play that way. So he's going to have to change the way he plays, right? Or he's going to get really upset. I think there's about a 20% increase and maybe
But it's mostly due to
motivation,
a switch in mentality.
I think so.
Got it. So that actually gives a lot of insight as to what is the biggest differentiator at those levels. It's here.
Right. But this is why guys like Guardiola, for example, look at his team compared to last year. Look at last year's team compared to the year before. Yes, some of the pieces are the same, but he's constantly adding players to the roster. You know, if you look at Sir Alex Ferguson's career at Man United, I know I'm going too far back, but I'm trying to think great coaches that stayed with a club for a long time. Cholo Simeone, you know, like you're changing guys because you wear guys out. You have to wear them out because you have to get them mentally. You have to get the most out of them. And some players just get to a point where they just can't handle it anymore. And at that point you lose them. So when you lose them, unfortunately, you got to move on from those players to other, but you have to be at a club that allows you to do that.
Yeah.
You know, the tough part is when you're a club where you can't change. So now you lost players and you're like, okay, now how do I motivate this guy? You know, I have to go to his house for dinner. He's got to come to my house for dinner. Like, what do I do? You know, like you're thinking of all of those things. But when I say come over to the house for dinner, I'm not exaggerating. Like You, as a coach, you got to do all of those things, whatever it takes.
Well, that's why you're called a manager also. It's not just coaching. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, and Mourinho is kind of infamous for this, right? It's 3 years. 3 years and it's over for him. He comes in, he parachutes it. Now he's probably going to parachute into Madrid, turn it around. But there's a time limit on this, right? He can't go on forever. And I guess it's the same thing with Inter Miami, right? With Messi. Messi drops in. And obviously Messi is Messi. But I imagine that everybody around him now is operating at peak performance. They don't want to mess around.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. Just by him being, you put him on the team, automatically the team is better, even if he does nothing.
Yeah. Cool, Tab. Look, I want to be respectful of your time. An hour and 10 minutes in. Is there anything that's kind of burning or something lingering in your mind that you want to get out?
No, not at all.
What's next? Are you still open to coaching? Do you want to coach?
No, I really don't want to coach. We've been discussing the whole time, it's a 24/7 job, really difficult, you know, and then you depend on the players, and then you still, you know, you're moving all around the country to then really, if you don't win, it's over anyway. So it's just, I've done it. It's been a great journey. If anything, I would still be open to being, you know, either a sporting director or a technical director somewhere. But I'm also not shopping myself for any of those, you know? So, yeah.
What are you most focused on then now or into the future? What do you want to do?
No. So I have a school here that's academics and soccer in the afternoon. Obviously I'm doing the podcast. I have a travel company that I started that does packages all over the world type thing. And then I work TV, like I'm doing the whole World Cup for HBS. You know, I do radio. I'm involved in the game as much as I can. Yeah.
I love it. Last question, because I'm into the media stuff also. Like how you said, as a coach, there's things that you can't say. Does that also kind of apply in the broadcaster's booth? There are things that you just can't say.
Well, of course, and there are things you can't say just because your network, let's say, won't allow you to say them, for example, right? And those could be political things or they could be just any topic that they may warn you against discussing, right? That can happen, of course. But then also it could be because, and you see it every day, because, you know, either you're affiliated with somebody or you're somebody's friend or you work for this. And, you know, in the U.S., for example, if we make a good example, you either don't want to speak a bit against U.S. soccer or against MLS or against somebody. Like there's always something, right, that you either feel that you can't say. I don't necessarily feel that because like I mentioned to you as we started the interview. And not that I would say anything, by the way, because there are some limits to things you can say. Otherwise, you're just a moron. You can't be a moron.
Yeah, of course.
You have to limit yourself. But I feel like I have good intentions. So I wouldn't go after anyone. If I'm doing an interview is always to either try to make the situation better or something like that.
Okay, I lied. One more. World Cup predictions. What do you think the U.S. is doing? I'm not going to hold you to it. Nobody's going to hold you to it. It's just for fun.
Well, I think the U.S. has a pretty good pathway to get to certainly the round of 32, but probably also the round of 16. I think that potentially, you know, a successful World Cup for this team will be getting to that quarterfinal game. If they get to the quarterfinal game, it will be a success. Anything less than a quarterfinal game for me, this World Cup will be a failure.
Got it. And what happens after? Who do you think they look for into hiring as the manager?
That's a very interesting question because we'll see what happens at U.S. Soccer, right? With Matt Cochran's exit, which was the most predictable exit ever. I think that it's going to depend who comes in and who's going to lead the way in terms of, you know, the search. But there's, you know, I think in the end, I think they'll go hopefully with an American coach. But I don't know. I don't know in which direction. I don't know which coach will be hot in the summer that people will talk about. So I think it depends.
Okay. I'll leave it there. I won't probe any further.
Yep.
Tab, thank you so much, man.
Thank you for having me on.
You got it. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.